From pop culture to politics, this is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, a great nation which for more than 75 years now has relied for a great deal of our defense from various menaces on the bomb. There's a history of that reliance and of the dangers posed by nuclear weapons today, not just nuclear weapons that the United States or Russia may possess, but nuclear weapons falling into other hands, the North Korean threat, the Iranian threat. And Fred Kaplan, in his already best-selling book, it is called The Bomb, Presidents, Generals, and the Secret History of Nuclear War. You think, well, what secret history of nuclear war? There hasn't been a nuclear war. The only two nuclear bombs that have ever actually been dropped were at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, right? Well, Fred Kaplan argues that we have come much closer to war than most Americans realize. Fred, it's a pleasure having you on the show.
Oh, thank you. And thanks for the confidence in that already best-selling remark.
No, Amazon says so.
Oh, that's true. Number one in military policy in Amazon. That's true. Yes.
Right, right. Well, we checked. We try to do our homework here. Fred Kaplan is the national security columnist for Slate, and he's the author of five other books, including The Wizards of Armageddon, which has to do with the creation of the nuclear deterrent by the United States. Now, let me just first go to this idea, because you have this provocative subtitle when you talk about the history of nuclear war. Given the fact that we really haven't, thank God, had a nuclear war, what do you mean by the history of nuclear war?
Well, there's been a lot of thinking and official planning about nuclear war. And as you suggested, there have been more times than most people are aware of that we came very close to nuclear war and escaped it in a couple of incidents because of a president's shrewdness. And in at least one incident on just blind luck, just the shrewd luck of having somebody in the lower levels of the bureaucracy decide not to do what he was supposed to do.
Okay, so let's deal with the presidential shrewdness first. I assume you're referring, having read much of your book, you're referring to President Kennedy and the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Well, the Cuban Missile Crisis is the main one. There was also a crisis over Berlin a year before that, where Soviet and Russian tanks faced each other across Checkpoint Charlie for 25 hours, and there was serious discussion, by which I mean a very detailed 33-page campaign plan to launch a preemptive first strike against Russian missiles if the Russians tried to take over West Berlin, which they almost did.
Okay.
Sort of a secret. Almost nobody has written about that. Although it's in the archives for anybody who wants to go looking.
Is that the pure dumb luck you were referring to?
Well, no, the pure dumb luck, there were some incidents around 1983. Well, there's one incident in particular where, because of an error in the Russian radar, the Russian radar showed that there were about 200 U.S. nuclear missiles coming their way. And the lieutenant colonel who was on duty with the Air Defense Command at that moment, decided at his own initiative that this is probably a mistake. This probably isn't really happening. And so he decided not to send word up to his superiors. And this was a moment of some tension. It could have, if he'd sent it up to the superiors, they might have got trigger happy. And in fact, there was no way of knowing that the attack was not really happening until the radar showed that the missiles were landing and exploding when, in fact, they weren't. And there was there have been some similar incidents like that on our side as well.
And when you say similar incidents on our side, this is 1983. This is almost the same time as the movie War Games.
That's right.
And
also, it was also the year of the Korean Airlines Flight 7 shoot down. And the incident I'm talking about, there was a war game that NATO was playing, a real war game, an exercise, and it was testing the procedures involved in making a transition from a conventional war to a nuclear war. And this was a very large war game. It was much larger and much more realistic than any war game of this sort that the United States or NATO had played. And now, this isn't just my own revisionist ramblings. This was the conclusion of a long study done a few years after the fact by the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board that was only declassified a few years ago. And they concluded that the Soviet leaders really thought that we were preparing for a first strike. And they started taking measures that they would take in response to a real mobilization. And on our side, there was a lieutenant general who is in charge of intelligence in Europe Command.
And I'm sorry, what year is this?
1983.
Also at 83. Go ahead.
And he looked at what the Russians were doing. And according to the procedures in the book, there are certain steps that he should have taken in escalating this in response to what the Russians were doing. But this lieutenant general decided, well, he was always very leery of the war game that NATO was playing. He thought it was too provocative. He figured that the Russians were just responding to what we were doing. And so he decided not to make the escalatory moves that the guidebook told him he would make. And in both of those instances, if somebody fairly far down in the chain had made a different decision, we could have come very close to actual war.
Okay, and one of the things that your book is extraordinarily informative about, the book, again, is called The Bomb, and it's Presidents, Generals, and the Secret History of Nuclear War, is that many people assume that, they launch a missile at us, we launch a missile at them, it's the end of the world, because mm-hmm. there are so many, literally hundreds, over 1,000 missiles that we have in our arsenal, and the Russians have comparable forces. And people assume that basically you're talking about the annihilation of the entire Earth. But that's not the way, as your book stresses, that strategic thinkers have been trained to look at a nuclear exchange. What's the difference?
Well, let's make a little context. At the very beginning, back in the late 40s, early 1950s, U.S. policy was exactly what you say. It was the actual U.S. policy was that if the Soviet Union or China invaded some area of vital interest to the United States, not with nuclear weapons, just with conventional weapons. This was at a time when we didn't have very many conventional armies to respond to such an invasion. The policy was to fire back, unleash all of our nuclear weapons against every target in the Soviet Union, China, and the satellite nations of Eastern Europe. And it was estimated that this would kill about 285 million people. Now, some people like General Curtis LeMay, who was the founder of the Strategic Air Command, thought this was the way you win a war. People like President Eisenhower, who declared this to be a policy of massive retaliation, thought this was a way that you deter a war. He thought that a war with the Soviet Union would inevitably go nuclear, and therefore the way to deter them was to make sure that they knew that we would destroy them if they launched one. But then what happened? In the early 60s, the Russians started to build their own nuclear arsenal. And so people got to think, well, if they invade West Germany and we respond by launching all of our weapons, nuclear weapons at the Soviet Union, they'll respond by launching all of their nuclear weapons at us. So this was a plan of suicide. And strategic thinkers, as you say, started thinking, well, how can we come up with a strategy and a plan and a type of arsenal that in the event of war, we can maybe just launch a small number of weapons and communicate in some way so that if the Russians respond at all, it would be with a small number of weapons, and maybe we can wind this thing down before it turns completely catastrophic. Now, I should add the people who came up with these ideas and that over time were actually incorporated into the war plan never had a lot of confidence that this would work out. There was, they had to bet on it. They would think, yeah, once nukes are used, it's going to be very hard to keep them under control. But they figured if there was even a small chance that this could be done, you know, let's try to make it so.
Isn't part of that idea that the first nukes that you used would not be aimed at population centers, they'd be aimed at other missiles, other
right.
nuclear resources?
That's right. That's true. And in fact, this has always been the case. The vast majority of nuclear weapons that we've deployed in the actual war plan have been aimed at military targets.
And they're also
seen as warfighting weapons. The problem, of course, is that these weapons are tremendously explosive. And a lot of military targets, both here and in Russia, aren't very far from cities. I mean, even in what people called a limited nuclear strike, millions of people on each side would die.
1-800-955-1776 is our phone number. I'm speaking with Fred Kaplan, author of the new, and I'll say it, bestseller, The Bomb. The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, which is an organization mm-hmm. that my late father was actually a member of at
uh-huh.
one point, does their doomsday clock. And
right.
they recently moved the hands forward, and I think they list us now as 3 minutes to midnight. Midnight, in their terms, means the end of the world.
Yeah.
Do you think they were right to reset the hands of the clock? Are we in graver yeah. nuclear danger today than we were, say, 10 years ago?
You know, I think, and I think that people of your father's generation would agree with this. When they started doing the clock, it was a very clever publicity scheme. And, I mean, it really did, back in the early days, alert people to the dangers of nuclear war. And, it's, you know, a lot of publicity for the magazine, too. But, you know, I think during the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was about as close as we came, I think they set the clock up to about 7 minutes till midnight. And so, you know, once you do that, it becomes a little hard to say that anything else is 5 minutes or 3 minutes or 2 minutes. And then once you have it at 2 minutes, you know, I mean, where do you go
yeah.
from there?
Right, especially because time evolves and
yeah.
all of a sudden
yeah.
you're 70 years from 5 minutes to midnight.
Right. So, you know, in its early day, I think it served a valuable function, but now it's a bit too much of a gimmick, and also it's not terribly. I don't, you know, look, this is a dangerous world, and all kinds of horrible things are happening and can happen. But to say we're 2 minutes away from doomsday, I you know, I don't know anybody who believes that.
I know that one of the time periods that you write about, where the United States came closer than anybody would like to remember to a nuclear exchange with Russia, was in October of 1973. And it's particularly relevant today because we had a president who was already enmeshed in an impeachment crisis. And there was the terrible confrontation in the Middle East with Russian support. Syria and Egypt had launched a surprise attack on Israel. How was that exchange between, and I believe both countries were on red alert, right? How did we avoid having a devastating war in 73?
Well, one thing that was interesting then is that Richard Nixon, he had come up with something called a madman theory. And this was laid out, Bob Haldeman, his chief of staff, described this in his memoir, in his diaries, where Nixon said, Bob, I have this thing. I want Henry Kissinger to go to the peace talks with the North Vietnamese and say, you know, this guy Nixon, he's kind of crazy, and he's uncontrollable, and he's terribly anti-communist, and I, you know, he's got his finger on the button, and I just can't predict what he'll do. And then he said Ho Chi Minh will come to the peace tables in, you know, in a minute.
It's a good cop,
well,
bad
just,
cop kind
the
of
thing.
The thing
is that nobody really quite believed it. I mean, with Nixon, whatever else you could say about him, nobody thought he would really do this. And again, during the, and so the North Vietnamese just kind of ignored it. And yeah, during the crisis in the Middle East, Nixon, he put the entire Strategic Air Command on alert. And, but again, the Russians didn't quite take it seriously. They figured he was sending some kind of signal, but didn't know what the signal was. So, yeah, the thing is, one difference between Nixon and Trump, and this could be said sort of perversely in Trump's favor, although if people make the wrong moves, it could end badly, is that people think that maybe Trump is crazy. You know, when he makes these you know, like fire and fury and these other kinds of threats, there's genuine concern that,
yeah,
that
he
maybe
might...
he means it.
Okay, speaking of that, wasn't Kim Jong-un was supposed to deliver some kind of horrible Christmas surprise to the United States?
Well, and... he talked about a Christmas present.
Yeah.
Yeah, we haven't seen it yet, although I don't know how to read that. One possible thing, it could be that he was planning an ICBM test, intercontinental ballistic missile test. I do know that the general who was in charge of that program was fired shortly after the new year. And some people...
If I fired in North Korea, does that mean killed?
Well, it's unclear. He was no longer had that position, let us say. He might have been killed. I don't know. Some of these people who are rumored to be killed show up at the podium, you know.
Right, after they've been fed to dogs.
We don't know, but it could well be that something was planned and there was just a technical flaw, either because of their own limited technology or, you know, I don't know if anything like this is going on, but remember the Stuxnet operation against Iran where there were secret U.S. cyber attacks against the Iranian uranium enrichment. There might be things like that going on.
Okay, you give the highest praise and for managing this nuclear issue to President Kennedy of the presidents in your book. And leaving aside the current incumbent, because the record is not clear yet, which president do you think brought us needlessly closest to war?
That's a good question. Needlessly closest to nuclear war. I mean, you mentioned Nixon.
Yeah.
Maybe so, except, you know, as I say, that nobody took it quite seriously, if they had taken it seriously. Now, or Reagan. Now, Reagan is a complicated figure, much more complicated than I knew when I went into the research. During his first term, he did aggravate tensions, and that's when all these crises in 1983 that I was talking about happened. And then he realized, kind of to his horror, that the Russians were taking these threatening things much too seriously. They really did fear a first strike. And so when Mikhail Gorbachev became president and he finally met with him, he was very keen to try to lessen the tensions. And so you could say that during the first term, Reagan brought us as close to war as just about any other president. But during his second term, you know, he and Gorbachev basically ended the Cold War. I mean, it's a remarkable turn of events, which quite a few of Reagan's advisors opposed at the time. They were much more skeptical about Gorbachev's intentions as a reformer than Reagan was. And there's a fascinating story about what turned the tide in Reagan's mind. The two leaders met in Geneva for the first time in 1985, and they started talking, and at first it was very tense. And then they went for a walk. This is at a chateau in Geneva. They went for a walk along the lake and ducked into a cabin where there was a fire blazing, and nobody was there but the two of them and their translators.
And oh God, thank the Lord, it worked out. The book is called The Bomb. It is fascinating, as is the author, Fred Kaplan. I wish you Godspeed and congratulations on The Bomb. It's posted up at our website. On the Michael Medved show, there's a story that in its initial stage, I was going to make short work of because it was just one of those passing strange and alarming stories, but it's turned much darker. And let me share it with you because I think it does illuminate a problem which is, I believe, one of the real crisis problems we face in this country that politicians aren't talking about. And by the way, it is a problem in Iowa. And it shocks me that none of the Democrats seem to be at all concerned about it. The story's out of Portland. And Portland, for people who don't know, is one of the big four cities in the country with the highest per capita so-called homeless population. I know you're supposed to refer to it as people experiencing homelessness, and even people sleeping out in the streets, in the parks, and in driveways. There was an incident in Portland where at 6:25 in the morning, which, by the way, when you live up here in the Northwest, it's still kind of dark at 6:25. The sun comes up very late this time of year and goes to bed very early. But there's a fellow leaving for work, and he'd backed up his car into the garage, and this is at an apartment building. It's one of those big garages with an automatic door opener. So he opened the door to the garage, and it's dark, and he's going out to work. And when he came out and pulled his car out and it was just leaving the garage, he felt a bump. That's his language. He stopped, the police later reported, but did not see what he had struck. He continued to pull out and felt another bump, police said. That's when he realized he had run over someone. He immediately did the right thing. He called 911 for help. And it turns out that the renter of this apartment, who was pulling out of his garage, had run over a homeless woman who was sleeping in the driveway of his garage. She was 47 years old. Her name was Tressel R. Stinson. She was transported to an area hospital with injuries that were not believed to be life-threatening. She was talking. She was conscious, but later that morning, police officers learned that Stinson's condition had taken a turn for the worse. The 47-year-old died later that same day at the hospital from her injuries. It's a terrible, terrible story. I thought of this because years and years ago, in Marina Del Rey, California, a friend of mine had the same experience of pulling out of a garage very early in the morning and pulling over a homeless person who was sleeping in the driveway of the garage. And in that situation, the individual was not killed. He recovered, thank God. But the reason it's even worth mentioning this is because Portland is one of those cities that has just been unable to get a grip on this homeless population. The background is amazing. In the Oregonian just did a homeless count that shows 20% more people sleeping outside in the latest homeless count. And it's been cold. And rainy. And Multnomah County, of course, is the county that Portland is in. Portland, with a metropolitan area of about 2.4 million people, has joined other West Coast cities such as Los Angeles and San Francisco in struggling with a growing homeless crisis that ranks among the worst in the country. You can add Seattle to that list. And at least in Seattle, the homeless crisis isn't growing. In Portland, it clearly is. The Oregon has the fourth highest number of homeless people in the nation when adjusted for population. Oregon has about 350 homeless people per 100,000 people. That's double the national average, which is 168 per 100,000 people. The study also found that Oregon, and this is not just Multnomah County, not just the county where Portland is, but the whole state of Oregon, the homeless rate has increased nearly 14% since 2014. Now, this is at a time when the state of Oregon, state of Washington, states around the country, and the federal government are spending more and more and more money on supposedly coping with this crisis, but it isn't helping. And this kind of thing, what do you do about something like this? Okay, you try to communicate to homeless people. Here's another number concerning the crisis in Oregon. And this is reported by Fox News in Portland. On any given night, thousands of people can be found sleeping on the streets of Portland. Thousands. The latest count released in August shows that in 2019, more people were sleeping outside than at any time in the last decade. Of the 2,037 unsheltered people, nearly 80% reported having one or more disabilities. What I fail to comprehend is when you have all of these cities, and we just did one here in Seattle. The weather's terrible. It's cold, it's rainy, it's wet, it's miserable. And living outside is, last night, my wife and I, it was our anniversary. Last night, we went out to an event downtown, and when we came out, it was just driving rain. We actually carried an umbrella, which you're not supposed to do in Seattle, and we almost never do, but this was appropriate. And there on the sidewalk, as we were going to our car, was a sleeping bag. And my heart sank, and because I had already read about this story, hadn't read that the individual died yet, but I thought there would be a person in the sleeping bag. There wasn't. It was just a soaking sleeping bag right in the middle of the street. If you're going to go to the trouble of doing a census and trying to find out what kind of disabilities people have and where they come from, and we're going to now find out about can't you do something to remove them from the streets? To compel them, whether they want to or not, to accept shelter. I mean, really, it's an insane situation. And you see parks that are covered with needles, and 80% having one or more disabilities. What kind of disabilities? You know what kind of disabilities. It's addiction and insanity. Mental illness, I know. We're not supposed to say insanity. But honestly, it is the policy that is insane, and it is the lack of attention to this. This impacts people every day, everywhere in America. And it is associated with the collection of litter. It's unbelievable. In Seattle, when you drive out to what's called the East Side over Lake Washington on the I-90, there is a collection of litter from a homeless encampment. The encampment, thank God, is gone. But the litter is just, it's a mountain. And it is ridiculous that with the amount of money that we all pay in taxes to maintain some kind of public order, that nothing is done. Meanwhile, somebody says she feels the urge to run in 2020. Who is it? Ha! We'll tell you coming up. And what is the state of the Democratic race just 6 days from the Iowa caucuses? Wow. The new national polling averages, and this is of all national polls, Biden 26%, Sanders 23%. Now, a lot of people look at that and they think, Sanders really is that close, then he wins in Iowa because he has more fervent support. and to get people to come out and declare themselves on a very cold night. And by the way, it falls off very dramatically after that. This is average of national polls. Biden 26, Sanders 23, Warren 15. She's 9 points behind Biden. And then Pete Buttigieg falling sharply down to 8%. Mike Bloomberg 7, Amy Klobuchar 4. Very, very strange. And then there's this number. This is from the New Siena College poll, national poll. Which of the two types of Democrats would you be likely to support? Brings politics in Washington back to normal or promises fundamental systematic change to American society? Okay, Democrats much prefer the fundamental systematic change to American society, meaning more free stuff and higher taxes for the people who are earning incomes. Which of the two types of Democrats would you be most likely to support? Someone you agreed with on most of the issues, or someone who has the best chance to beat President Trump? That's a tie. So beating President Trump is not the biggest concern. Which would you prefer? Someone who is more liberal than most Democrats or someone who's more moderate than most Democrats? They prefer a moderate in the Democratic side, 55 to 38. In other words, at the same time, they prefer a moderate. They also prefer somebody who promises fundamental systematic change to American society. What's moderate about that? Internal contradictions in Democratic thinking? Well, sure. And there's this internal contradiction from Hillary Clinton, who, of course, is out busy promoting her book on gutsy women. And she had this to say in an interview with Variety magazine.
I know that you're not running, but do you ever feel the urge that, like, I could beat him if I were? Or, like, I wish I, you know.
Yeah, I certainly feel the urge because I feel like the 2016 election was really an odd time and an odd outcome. And the more we learn, the more that seems to be the case. But I'm going to support the people who are running now and do everything I can to help elect the Democratic nominee.
And I'm going to do everything I can to help elect the Democratic nominee. Do you think she would be really active in a Bernie Sanders campaign? From after she says that everyone hates him, he has no friends, he's never accomplished anything, if she'd go out and support him? I'm thinking not so much. And speaking about support, there's a powerful piece about the actual American position on abortion, which is overwhelmingly moderate. In other words, the American people, to great, great numbers, support more restrictions on abortion, but not total restrictions on abortion. In other words, abortion in some cases, first 3 months, yes, people support that. But overwhelmingly, over 70% of Americans say they want more restrictions on abortions of babies who have developed more than 3 months. So this is why it is so strange that on Shrill, which is a show on Hulu, and it stars the very talented comedian A.D. Bryant from SNL, Saturday Night Live. She played Sarah Huckabee Sanders, among other people, on SNL. In Shrill, she comments about definitions of self-care. Listen.
Women are made to feel so insecure, and then each insecurity is like a new opportunity to make more money.
It's sad.
Yes. And all day, all they talked about was self-care. But it's not taking care of yourself to agree that you're ugly and you need to be fixed.
Okay, so what is a moment of true self-care if you strip everything away here? What's an example?
Well, I mean, if I'm being honest, like, the first thing that I think of is my abortion, you know? I mean, that was care. I had to, in the moment, evaluate what I wanted and take care of myself, and then all the women that were there that took care of me.
Thanks for telling me. I mean, this is totally your call, but you could, you know, put that in the article.
Yeah, I mean, I'm I'm not afraid to. It's just the truth.
Well, then go do it.
Okay.
Okay. Abortion as self-care. A slogan for the Democrats. You don't think that the left is out of touch with the majority of Americans on that definition? I'll tell you, when you talk about the majority of Americans, a lot of people came out to see and greatly admired the new movie Harriet. It actually won a major Oscar nomination for Best Actress for Cynthia Erivo. Is it historically solid, and is it worth seeing? It's just coming out on Blu-ray and DVD and in digital formats. Listen.
Now, it's time for Medvid on Movies.
In 1849, a runaway slave named Minty makes a perilous journey entirely on her own before she arrives in the free state of Pennsylvania and begins a new life in the amazing true story, Harriet. New on DVD and video on demand.
I don't know if you know how extraordinary this is, but you have made it 100 miles to freedom all by yourself. Would you like to pick a new name to mark your freedom?
Harriet Tubman.
That's Broadway actress Cynthia Erivo, who is outstanding in this role. And like the real-life Harriet Tubman, she stands barely 5 feet tall. Nonetheless, this American heroine risks her life more than a dozen times by going back into the slave state of Maryland, leading others to freedom, and winning the historic designation Moses.
If I'm free, my family should be too. I made up my mind, I'm going back.
When trouble comes, you'll be ready.
Why are you back here? It ain't safe.
I come to get you. Bring all of you to freedom.
Harriet, welcome to the Underground Railroad.
Do you know what would happen if you got caught?
I made it this far on my own, so don't you tell me what I can't do.
This is a remarkable, historically responsible film that conveys Harriet Tubman's courage with immediacy and impact. It also respectfully portrays her deeply religious Christian outlook, where she's guided for her survival and heroics by visions and voices. There is one distracting element with an invented character played by Joe Alwyn, who's supposed to be the grandson of a plantation owner who seems to have complicated romantic feelings toward Harriet. The movie's rated PG-13, with the horrors of slavery felt more than seen. Director co-writer Cassie Lemons, previously known for Eve's Bayou and Black Nativity, should get Oscar consideration for an exceptional achievement. 3 stars for the formidable Harriet. And the movie actually was a box office success, not so successful for the impeachment cause, but there's just this breaking news. Mitch McConnell says the GOP leadership does not currently have enough votes to block impeachment witnesses. McConnell reportedly, according to the Wall Street Journal, not the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, McConnell made those remarks in private Senate GOP meetings. Does that mean we are going to have witnesses? Yeah, it probably does. And I've thought that all along. Is that a disaster? I don't think it's a disaster. And I think that the Republicans will be able to call some witnesses that Republicans want to call as well. Stay tuned. Tomorrow, we'll be speaking to my brother in Jerusalem about the impact of the new peace plan. We'll also talk about question time beginning in the impeachment process in this greatest nation on God's green earth.